Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back to Press Pause, where I have the absolute pleasure of interviewing creatives in the TTRPG space to talk about what they do and why they do it. Today, we have an awesome guest here, a game designer, Graham Gentz. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
First off, we got to ask the big question of how did you happen into this world of games? What was your introduction into the space?
I mean, there's so many different kinds of games, and there's so many different ways to answer this question. I think that my favorite way to answer it is that plain pretend is the greatest thing ever. And when I was first meeting friends on the playground that you know, you're 4, 5, 6. What's your name? How old are you? Do you want to be friends? And then immediately you were. Pretend was the great game that like all other things kind of lapsed into. And I often talk about when people are like, oh, I used to play Dungeons and Dragons in high school and I never got back to it or whatever. It never lost the magic for me. So it was very easy as a kid who was always reading and imagining and doing things and taking part in theater and then finding outlets for those things that once I found all of the things kind of combining that I did, I just never let go.
Was your first game you played in the tabletop space D&D?
Yeah, in about sixth grade or so, third edition had come out and, I had the beginner box. And so I brought it into my middle school and went to the games club, and the games club was 7 tables of people playing chess and me in the corner running, third edition Dungeons and Dragons for 8 sixth graders. And having no idea what I was doing, and it was absolutely glorious. The scenario had one room and one door, and they all started on the outside, and we had a grid, and all the players were trying to shove in, but initiative meant that only one player could go. And so one would be at the back of the room, but they'd say, well, what can I do? And me not knowing anything, I'd say, I guess you could do a strength check to move them out of the way. And so what proceeded for about 30 minutes was them doing strength checks and chucking each other over, trying to get to the one door until one person got through and then got surrounded by goblins and all just attacked him. And eventually they got through. But I was like, this is a disaster. And like the very next day, all of those kids came up to me in the hall and was like, can we play that again?
Sometimes it doesn't matter what's going on as long as you're having fun in a fantasy world, you know?
Yeah, and I love doing this, especially with kids even now, because being young is all about a lack of agency, and role-playing games are all about making choices and your agency mattering. And so as a result, when you're in a place where you're being told what to do and where to go by parents and teachers and adults and everything in between, all of a sudden there is a kind of play where the rules enforce your choices mattering. And so as a result, like there couldn't be a better place for kids to explore.
So you jumped in right away to kind of GMing games. When did the shift come from like creatively creating a story to being like, oh, what if I delved into the mechanics? What was like your impetus to start designing?
Yeah, that's immediate. And I think that it's also immediate with like everybody else. One of my big soapboxes is that everyone homebrews, but design with a capital D are like separate. And for me, they're exactly the same. I love it. And nobody really tells people to do it, but inherently people understand, oh, I can morph this thing. I can change it. I can do what I want. Even the cultural shift of hacks has been really positive for the space, because the term originates as a pejorative, but then all of a sudden people were doing hacks of systems again around this time of kind of the burgeoning indie scene, and they were seen as capital D designers, which is great. So every time I was picking up something and trying to say like, how does this work, and tinkering with it is no different for everybody else does. I just, my big thing, if people take one thing away, it's that you are a designer if you're homebrew, and your homebrew is great and I want to play it.
That's a great sentiment to have. I've never thought about it like that, but you're totally right. If game designing starts at that level, when did you feel like you were, I suppose, was it like your first published work that you felt like you might be doing this like at a professional level?
It comes down to community. Everybody is so isolated, and part of role-playing games inherently, and even just like tabletop games, they are defined by the people you're with, and then the people you get to share those experiences with. And when I finally managed to go to a big convention, I lived far, far away in New Mexico and only heard tales of these things. It was expensive to travel, and I didn't know what I was doing. And so eventually I got to one, and it was sort of a three-day process of going on the show floor and being like, wow, this is overwhelming and amazing, because I'd always lived in my little bubble and I'd been the evangelist, being sharing new games and new ideas with people around and being like, just humor me and like, check this thing out. The second day I found the IPR booth, and was the first time I had finally seen games that I hadn't heard of, but like a bunch of them only I had talked about. And I was like, oh my gosh, there is a community here. And on the last day, I found Indie Games on Demand, which was people running these games, oftentimes the designers. And so I got to then meet them as people and start to see what the process was like. And I think the isolating thing about being a creative is that as you get closer and closer to completion, you lose context steadily until you're all the way at your destination, your nose is pressed against the glass, and the feelings of self-doubt and really having no context at all, basically, oh, this is terrible, I'm terrible, everything I'm going to make is terrible. And that is why community is so important. People are doing these things together, and what drew everybody to this stuff is that for love. I think the step one is love, and that's why it's different from other communities and other industries. And so being inspired by other people's work from afar was different from talking to people and being part of their processes and then saying, you know what, I think that there's a space for me to step forward and do a thing, as nerve-wracking as it was.
Do you feel that a lot of game design is other game designers consulting each other on their games?
Sometimes. I think again, it's very cultural. I think that a lot of the individual movements that are currently around, like NSR, Mouse Ritter, and Into the Odd, and all these things, are defined solely by the culture of design and what choices are being made. And so there's really a lot of creators out there because they see other people doing it, and because the road to access is so easy. The Morkborg and other Porg things is completely open source. And as a result, anybody who jumps into the pool has a fighting chance against the tides of capitalism, which is always something that everybody deals with. And I think that in the best possible forms, community, connection, and designers talking to each other creates inspiration. And then as you get past that, for me, the important 50% mark, you have to be 100% enthusiasm to that point, because if you don't get there, it's just going to fall off. And then after that is when it just gets harder and harder steadily. So I think that's always the connection that like makes everything work properly.
Well, you've been working in games for quite a while. Do you feel like you have a specific type of tabletop game you're drawn to, whether that is to play or create? Like, is it a genre? Is it a theme? Is it some sort of mechanic that kind of pull you in, or are you more broad scoped?
Yeah. My interest has always been diverse. In a past life, I helped run a couple board game cafes. But every time I go to a convention of any kind and I have an opportunity to play games, they're always RPGs. If I have, you know, a binary choice, unfortunately, and I have to do one, I'm always going to go that. And the RPGs that I'm drawn to are the ones that are as experimental as possible, as odd as possible, that really push the boundaries of like what is being defined as a game or play in an unstandard way. They are the kinds of games that I played that in my own development as a role player, as a designer, that were big watershed moments. I tend to play a lot of GMless games and I try to write them because I think that they have this huge step up in terms of communicating a certain philosophy. And for me, the games that I want to make and the games that I want to play and I'm most curious about are the ones that are intentional with these spaces. For me, I'm about trusting the player's agency and creating as thin as a hierarchy as possible, because players aren't empty vessels for story to be subjected upon. And the creativity and the interest and the knowledge of players should be lead towards, not against. And I feel like for decades, there's all of this sort of deeply hierarchical and, for me, troubling philosophy that is all embedded. So the games that are trying to uproot this as much as possible, address it, or at the base level understand it is, for me, like a starting point.
Way that I came to be aware of you is through your game Under the Autumn Strangely, which I really like. But for our audience, could you give a little rundown of what that game is?
Yeah. So the tagline I had to use is that Under the Autumn Strangely is a GMless story game. It's a game of pastoral horror and anachronistic Americana in a land that never was. When you see the art design, and I even shout it out on the back, the point of aesthetic inspiration is Over the Garden Wall. But part of that is about the emotional communication I'm trying to do. It's very much not Graham Gentz's Over the Garden Wall game. Because why I made the game is because I was so curious about the kind of wellspring of the way it had a reaction, the way it was resonating with people. People I didn't know, just random strangers having conversations at parties or something, it always just kept coming up. Oh, it's my favorite show. Oh, I watch it every single year with the group. And then also the diverse amount of answers. My very talented cover artist, Jenza Deladonna, when I first approached her about this project, said, oh, I love Over the Garden Wall. It's so cute. Which, of course, it is. I just would have never thought personally to describe it that way, because I think Pottsfield is the greatest thing ever. And so I didn't want to design so I say it's a horror game, but there's no mechanics about making it horrific. I'm basically banking on the fact that the players are going to make it as much or as little as they want. And all of the ways that I have the mechanics, but also framed it, is basically that it's like a Ouija board, and that the players all have equal agency and ability to create as they go. And I want every game to be tailored subconsciously to how the players want it without having asked for it. And that's what they do. So the huge variety of tones are possible because players are pushing and pulling and finding it as they go. So the goal was not to do a kind of horror game that I enjoy personally, because I am a big horror person as a kind of genre, but I wanted to have this sort of reflective mirror that reflected the players and what they wanted there as a result of play.
Yeah, you have in the game three roles, which are the Traveler, the Arcadian, and the Terror. What was it about these specific that were important to how you wanted the game to turn out? Were there others in like the design process that got changed or shifted or thrown out? Or was this kind of always where it was headed?
Yeah, this was a game that, so I love playtesting. It's my handle at most things because I love being a creative space of finding new games, talking with people, giving and receiving critique. My background is as a writer. And so as a result, I've been to many, many seminars and read many things, and people have read my stuff. So it's a format I'm very comfortable with, and the exploratory part. That said, when I first wrote the like immediate draft of Under the Autumn Strangely, it was almost exactly the way that it is now in its current form. And in terms of the roles, I'm a big fan of asymmetry and odd numbers. I think that asymmetry can often be boring, but as long as it's emphasized in terms of both visual design, but aesthetic. And so I liked the idea of three roles all kind of balancing each other, because it meant that, again, we're suggesting a lack of hierarchy and relationships being the core idea. And so being the fundamental idea of, you know, lost in an unknown world, these kinds of stories, which are so common, I started filling out in my head what these fundamental elements were. I'm a big fan of deconstructionism as kind of a lens to talk about media or other kinds of critical thinking. And so the idea of a point of view character defining things as they saw them, the dream logic of I see a thing and now it exists. And then, okay, well, what is the kind of emotional blanket that everyone is being felt in? And so you are sort of environmental, but I wanted to make sure it was not a GM by any means. But again, just the focus. You can only spend so much time thinking and narrating. And so where am I asking players to focus? And then there had to be some kind of complicator. And I think by separating the Terror and the Arcadian also meant that the relationship between each of them individually was very strongly defined, which is kind of what I was going for.
Yeah, you had mentioned earlier about, and just actually in this question I just asked you about, like, getting rid of a hierarchy and this being a GM-less game. Aside from that hierarchy that you're removing, what type of play do you think not having a GM in this game specifically kind of helps facilitate?
Yeah, it underlines my larger philosophy of players being the most important. I was just at Gen Con and happened to be the first time I'd ever been on a panel. And it was a very similar panel that I went to all those years ago as somebody with a taking notes and shaking in my boots, being like, I hope I can do this. And so I got to be the person being like, please make more games. And one of my co-panelists talked about the GM being the most important person. And I very quietly disagreed and said it's all about the players. And the traditional format of a GM is like the steepled fingers and, you know, you're a master and a god with a capital G. And I find it all very troubling, and not just troubling, but it actively makes the games worse, I think, both the culture of play and the act of playing is part of it. And so when I was looking to kind of remove that, the idea is how do you replace it? How do you create it? And then how do you empower players to kind of have that? And so having each buddy have total equal power in terms of being able to create freely, but then a tonal responsibility meant that you were less focused on that aspect of what you're adding and how you're interacting, but it also meant you had to be listening to people. And that's kind of one of the secret sauces. There's a phrase in game design of the fruitful void, which is the idea of all of the different mechanics and they kind of swirl around, but what is unwritten and what is happening in the middle? And for me, active listening is one of my secrets for the games I facilitate myself or am part of and try and design, because if everybody is jumping in and taking their turn and not actually acting in the space, then it doesn't work. And then you don't have the kind of tonal sharing and shifting and finding. Is the game truly horrific? Is it something else? I've had games where I've sat back and listened after facilitating, and the Terror ends up being extremely sympathetic and sort of the protagonist. And if I had written anything about this is the way it has to be done, then all of those stories wouldn't have happened.
I wanted to make a comment about GMs and them, the quote from somebody else saying that they're the most important part. I think what's super hard about that too is oftentimes in games where you do need a GM to facilitate it, people forget that the GM is also a player. And so they become kind of this outside of the story, as you said, like God with a capital G. And whenever they try to like step in and have a good time themselves or have fun, it's kind of rebounded back on them that that's not their role. And I think that's unfortunate because, again, you're all at a table playing this game together. And so I have found recently, in as I have tried to explore more types of TTRPGs, and especially in indie games, that the GM-less ones do facilitate a lot stronger of communal storytelling than games in which I'm kind of putting the story out for people to respond to rather than to actively create.
Yeah, it's very true. And I think is the natural course of people finding this thing, getting the RPG spark, and then falling into it, especially if they have a close group of friends that they can experience it with. You know, the stories of like 2 or 3 year long D&D campaigns where it's not even Forgotten Realms and you're all tiefling bards and you have a small business. Like, those stories fill me with such joy, because I'm like, yeah, you're playing it right. Like, that is absolutely what you should be doing. I think that outside of GM-less games, which again is this, it's a step up in terms of a kind of philosophy being communicated, which is why I have such interest in them. A proper game that is still GM'd, there are certain kinds of things you can look for that let you know that the system is aware or the writers are aware of these kinds of things. The phrase player facing is pretty important. So if you have a game where the GM never rolls dice, great. If there are just levers that you're pulling, if there's a philosophy of play as part of the mechanics, the idea is that the games that are happening are less arbitrary, but they're also about what the player's choices are. It's less you creating a story and more adapting to what the players are doing. A big part of that is buy-in. Oh, how do I get my players to care? By having fun yourself and by interacting with the back and forth, the tennis match of it. I feel very strongly about somebody who preps or over-preps for a game is playing their own game and they're not playing the game at the table. There's all these memes of, oh, the players, you can't control your players. They can't, they won't do what I want. I built this whole dungeon map and all they want to do is sell lemonade in a lemonade stand. Those dang PCs. And from my point of view, the lemonade stand is the game, and that person is doing it wrong. They're not listening to the players. The players wanted to have that game, and then if they were more engaged with that, everyone would be having a good time, them included. And so this is what I'm talking about. It's just there needs to be more intentionality and more conversation about why it occurs. And I have my own personal things about why and how I think a healthy table, a happy table, an excited, engaged table can and does occur. But I want people to be able to have these intentional conversations with their groups and at their tables.
The mists roll across the valley over the bodies of hundreds of dead as a large figure rises above the mountains, too large to be anything mortal. Enter Pocket Bard, immersive audio made easy. With an ever-expanding music library, Pocket Bard has made soundscaping for your TTRPG needs seamless and so, so, so very simple. The easy-to-use app provides you with scenes that include ambiance, weather patterns, quick and easy sound effects, as well as backing music with just a touch of a button. Transitioning from town to a long travel journey? Don't worry. A large selection of the music and soundscapes adjust to your adventures, transitioning seamlessly into the next scene. You'll unlock a wide variety of music for all genres of play so that you can weave an incredible tapestry that'll make playing at your table even more memorable than it already was. Check out Pocket Bard at www.pocketbard.app or head to your nearest app store on iOS or Android to access the magic right now.
Have you been wanting to bring your home games to the next level? Maybe you're looking for the perfect holiday gift for the TTRPG-loving person in your life. Well, during the Hero Forge Black Friday sale, you can get savings as big as the stories you tell. Maybe you're a DM and you want to gift something physical to your players of their player characters in your campaign. Or maybe you're a player and you want to give the gift of an NPC in the form of a miniature. You can save 20% on physical miniatures and accessories, such as their iconic color plastic miniatures, their new, super cute custom acrylic keychains, or their 3D printed custom dice, as well as 50% on digital miniatures and STL files. The sale ends December 1st, so don't delay! Restrictions apply. Head to heroforge.com/sale for more details.
Your next favorite game is on My First Dungeon.
Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon. Hello and welcome to My First Dungeon. Ho, 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 and welcome to My First Dungeon.
From Sad Space Cowboys,
Kumari takes out a lighter from their pocket and goes, this bar's next.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Let's go.
To death metal Viking cats.
Hello Kitty, you see Melody Tuffington flying through the air, jacked as shit, massive legs, to horny snowmen?
The sad part is that Joshua never gave Frosty a penis.
No.
And everything in between.
It was a dark and stormy night.
We've got something for everyone.
You're a special Gertrude girl in a special Gertrude world. Happy birthday, happy birthday. I'm not a skeleton.
Learn the game, then hear it in action.
That's Snake Eyes minus two. That's a zero.
Snake Eyes, that means that we have our very first plot twist. Anytime somebody rolls doubles, we get a plot twist.
So grab some headphones.
And get lost in a story with us.
I'll be honest, I don't know all the rules of it. We'll kind of figure that out as we go. But do you want to just play? I've got some great stories to tell you.
And remember,
if you're having fun, you're already doing it right.
Oh, fuck.
And this question could kind of totally be on me and my small amount of knowledge about the wide array and plethora of games that exist in the world. But I personally haven't run into one that has like a built-in playlist. And you made one for Under the Autumn, strangely. What was the impetus for that? Was it trying to help set the tone? Was it trying to help set the setting? Was it just fun?
I mean, yes, all of the above, yes, because it's deeply personal. It's going to be difficult for me to ever design a game that doesn't involve music. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is one of the things I've been doing while facilitating for a very long time is using music while I play. And not just throwing on an ambient track, but like actively DJing while things are going on. In eighth grade, I went over to my friend's house for an RPG sleepover with just like two other people. And their father had a 100 CD changing stereo. And so I burned two CDs. One was the Fallout 1 soundtrack, and the other was of the Trigun soundtrack. And I memorized the track listings. And while I was facilitating for my friends, I had a remote and I had memorized, and I was switching in between the different sessions. And so whenever I play with a new group or people, they notice this is something that I'm doing. As a result, for the game design aspect, when I was first thinking about what I wanted to do, I was just really taken with the opening monologue. And so all of my intentional pieces that I phrase in the book about the opening narration and what it defines, and at a point of your emotional choosing. So allowing players to feel that out for themselves, you listen to a song, you feel it, and there's no rhyme or reason. It's not do it for 30 seconds, do it for 60 seconds. You know, and you jump in. So as a result, again, what I'm interested in people discovering at the table is their choices, and their choices mattering, because what they're going to do is going to make sense in that moment and for that game and for their experience. So much of it was that, but then also there's always like this underlying kind of artistic and political things that I'm doing with what I chose for those tracks in particular, and what I think that they communicate. And then even in the example of play in the beginning, I have the characters question if they have to use the playlist, and I breach space and time and come in and say, no, it's fine. You can do whatever you want. And then I leave as a character. Again, just trying to say, yes, these things are here, but also there's no game police, and that being the important part.
This might be a bit more of like a in the weeds question of production time. But how did Under the Autumn, strangely, kind of come to be from the moment of your inspiration to when it was out there for the public?
Yeah, a great way to answer this is also advice to like new game designers and people looking to get in, which is that Zine Quest and Zine Month are these annual events, and they're really, really important and lovely. The barrier to entry is very low, and also it gives people visibility because there's, you know, always worries about the noise of the other games going on and the kind of self-conscious idea of how could I possibly stand out. And also, there's plenty of people that like supporting it. For me, my favorite games to buy are not 400-page hardback books. They are those $10, $5 zines that are like stapled together because they're ideas. And because that dollar amount emotionally means so much more to the person that I'm giving it to than to me. And I love that sort of punk rock selling CDs out of the back of your car kind of feeling. And it's all these different ways that we like build community and fight against the evils of capitalism together, this kind of crushing ennui that we all experience universally. So Zine Quest for me felt like it was a really great opportunity to have a full project beginning to end that grew in the scope. I hadn't done one for it specifically, and so it gave me the impetus to go through it, which meant that I had to do more work. I was the beginning, middle, and end of the project, which is also nerve-wracking. But now that it was done, I can say that I haven't just been part of crowdfunding, that I did everything about it, and I learned so much. And I didn't crash and burn. And so as a result,
congratulations.
Like, thank you. You know, all these different stages of talking to backers, finding printer, and then getting them sent to my house, figured out how I was going to send all these addresses, and then literally putting them into these little packages in my living room and being able to send them out. So doing a lot of research and, again, having other people who've done it before help me. And then giving that back as a result. So the timeline from idea to pitch was 2 weeks. Don't recommend that. and then I was going to do layout myself, and I brought in my very dear friend, Ryan Kahn, who's another game designer who makes wonderful games like Bug Dish, which is where you play bug chefs. The process of the actual manuscript and then layout was maybe about 6 months. And then getting it out was maybe another three. And so that was like printing and logistics and getting everything done and getting stuff sent out and getting backers to respond. The last little thing that I'll say was a huge help to me is that BackerKit is a crowdfunding platform, but they have fulfillment support, which, holy geez, did that tell me so much and help me out and really give a lot of things. That service alone, in terms of getting it to backers, trying to figure out shipping, the logistical stuff that I had no experience with, was a massive help.
Well, speaking of Kickstarters, you also had another successful one that just ended back in March. Tell me a little bit about Love for the Love Gods.
Yeah, Love for the Love Gods. The elevator pitch for that is it's Cabin in the Woods, but for Hallmark movies. I because of my background as a writer, it was burned into me that you need a log line. And when the title is the part of the long line, that's also part of what I was told over and over and over again. And so you have a single line description and the title should bring it together. So every time I see a movie that's immediately got a double entendre in it, like all of my screenwriting professors are like, yes, good, good. And so for me, I like the double hit of the premise and then making it people's head snap back. And then the title kind of bring it together as well. And so what that game is, if you haven't seen Cabin in the Woods, I hate to spoil it for you, but it's a metatextual movie about horror movies. So it asks these broad questions about why are all horror movies the same and what is the purpose of them, particularly your like slasher movies, your kind of like 70s, 80s, where you have teenagers in the woods and they're being killed by a thing and then what that is, you know. by the 90s, it was getting stale. And so things like Scream were suddenly having like meta commentary because it needed to like mix them up. And I feel like Cabin in the Woods did such an excellent job of hitting that, partially because it's the idea of sacrifice. And there's these literal kind of Lovecraftian entities. But for me, it's not just that. It also plays in for the audience. The gods of this world, I think, is very much the horror movie audience. And so not only is it just the literal text of what is happening in the movie and a result of what it's commenting on, it's also about movie making and storytelling and what the audience is for these things, you know. And so I often look at media that gets punched down on and think about how and why. And for me, it usually comes back to like heteronormativity and patriarchy and white supremacy. And so thinking about how Hallmark movies were all the same, it mainly made me think about the Cabin in the Woods kind of breakdown. And so that was one piece, but the rest of it was, okay, well, how do I take this even further? For me, it's not enough to just have a meta commentary on it and even have this like step up, because people will probably have familiarity with the thing that I'm riffing on. Also, Hallmark as a brand is aggressively straight and aggressively white. And so that's what led to my the tenets of the Love Gods, which up front is that queer stories don't have to be tragic. Because that is kind of the common thread, that they're always forbidden love and there's always death and it's always about abuse and trauma and like finding true love. And that's fucking exhausting.
It is really exhausting, if you can tell by my heavy sigh.
I think it's so aggravated as somebody who pays attention to media and thinks about media and has all this stuff. And so something I've learned in my time playing games, running games, is the importance of earnestness and also being silly or stupid, and those not being mutually exclusive. And so those are those big layers. And then as a result, the game is this like really dense, layered meta upon meta thing, where you are in kind of a Truman Show-esque perfect set. But there's secret agents of the love machine or machine, and so maybe that they are backstage, as it were, and making little pyrotechnics happen to kind of like get these lovers together. But then each round there's also a sort of wordless love god, which again, all of these roles are constantly rotating, and so it has most of my philosophies of players putting in their stuff, defining it at the table, me saying what these things are and labeling them. So in Under the Eye of Strangely, it's, I want you to bring these things to the table. It's stone soup. But what those things, for me, importantly, need to be defined and brought by the players, because that's buy-in and that's excitement. So the first thing you do in Under the in A Love for the Love Gods, create the most perfect town. And so I have all of these list of things about like, what is a an annual festival, what is a broad general theme that the whole town is, such as purple or Christmas or snails. The one that I'm very proud of, because I know that it's like the immediate first answer that everybody grabs, is come up with a adorable local cryptid. And that's the thing where everyone's like, me! and I'm like, ha-ha, it worked!
I got you!
So that's the broad strokes of Love for the Love Gods.
It's pitched as a queer collaborative storytelling game, and I found that one of the questions that has been coming up a lot in this kind of like grouping of interviews I've been doing recently is, what do you think is the biggest difference in games that are intrinsically queer versus games that a table can make gay at the table, but it doesn't have it like built into the system?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because it has to do with like queer coding. It has to go with like analysis, but also it has to go with like my personal feelings on art, creation of art, and the nature of queer art. So full stop, all art is political. And what does that mean? It's created by people, and people are political. And the idea of what politics is has to do with culture. So another way to say that is that, everything is already culture. And so as a result, there is this sort of separation. When I create art, what is it and how is it defined by the choices I'm making, consciously or unconsciously? And so there is this kind of broad idea of like, what is queer art? And oftentimes it's about queer characters or themes or ideas, but I get up a little, I'm like, well, isn't what is and isn't queer art? And if a queer person makes a piece of art, isn't that queer art? Because how could it not be? I think back to queer coding, because it's not like queer people suddenly appeared in 1961. And it's making art for a very long time, where there's a phrase I love to go back to, which is like, why do you got to make it gay? And I'm like, because it is gay, because inherently it's gay. And that's also like, but it's also many different things. Like, it's not just one thing or another. There's a lack of binaries in how we define things, but as humans, particularly as these sort of like power structures, like we need to know what little groups we can put people in, and you're either one thing or you're not, you know, and you see this all in all kinds of ways in which stratification occurs in society. So when you're talking about, you know, movies from the golden age of Hollywood, and you're like, wow, you know, this Gladiator movie seems really gay. It's not just you seeing it. The creators, the writers are gay. And particularly in, it's not Spartacus, Ben-Hur. The writer of Ben-Hur was a queer man and wrote all these themes. And when you watch it, it's like blisteringly passionate between these two friends. And I looked into it and they specifically were like, don't tell Charlton Heston this is what we're doing. And so as a result, like it's just part of the expression of that thing. Just because it says on the tin it is or isn't queer doesn't make it queer or not queer. And I think it says a lot about art and a lot about humans.
Well, I've got kind of a fun ending-ish question for you now.
I like fun.
Can you tell me one of your favorite moments at a table? Anything, it could be sad, it could be funny, but just kind of something that you remember and look back on fondly.
It's like, what do I pick and then what do I choose to highlight? Because I love these kinds of stories and I love thinking about them and like how they changed me. And honestly, the big ones are that kind of click of alchemy, that thing where it becomes this greater than the sum of its parts. People have the buy-in. They truly care about what's happening and they're making decisions based on that, not based on anything else. And plenty of those have been in games that I was playing and experiencing as a character. They've been games in which I've been a facilitator because I have such an intentional philosophy about how I think a table can and should be run. Things like my half-joking, now serious safety tool, the O-Card, is a big part of that because I believe so strongly in these micro-communities being made at the table. But what I've experienced since Under the I'm Strangely's publication is that my favorite thing is to have a full table of six and I don't play. I just teach the rules and then I help for those moments in which players have a direct question. But even if they're like, quote unquote, doing it wrong, I will not step in and like correct them or anything. Because each and every time the games are so radically different and so exciting to me. For me, a big part of why role-playing games create this magic is because you're obliterating the line between participant and audience member. I guess the game that I facilitated it and six people took it away and were amazing. It was at Gen Con. It was a session and it started off darker than I'd really anticipated. Both Arcadians were just like slamming in with like the actually you're walking on finger bones immediately. And so the Terran were like kind of sitting back, be like, what are we supposed to do? But they kept pulling it too. And so you had two characters in a deeply disconcerting first chapter with like big ants carrying the grubs and talking to them and being lost. And it ended with the both travelers asking themselves if they were not actually human. And that was the fade out. And then the second one, they realized that they were the same person, that they were different parts of time. It was the younger person and the older person, and that nobody was sad that they had died. And they spent it around at their funeral. And they're like, okay, we've established all these things. We don't know where it is. We're not human. We're the same person. They're piecing all these together. And I'm just at the edge of my seat being like, this rips. Like, I couldn't be happier to be here. And right at the end, one of the terrors starts kind of narrating the parts of their lives about decay and ends and things falling. And they look at each other and they say, are we death? And there's a few strong moments in which they were very excited to be death. And their terror says, no, you're autumn. And there was fade out. That was well done, everybody. And it just felt so meta and so weird and started at such a weird place, but mm-hmm. then got to this emotionally resonant, like quieter moment. And they did that themselves. It was all them. It was all them listening to each other and creating as they went. It felt like a complete home run. And I was so happy to be there while they were doing it.
You did mention the O card briefly, and so I just want to say that I think that is actually super cool because the O card is like a silent paper you can put down on the table in the middle of a game to say that you really liked what just happened. And I think in this surgence of safety tools, which I think are super important, but all of them are kind of negatively connotated, and like the X card is, we can't be doing this, or you need to take a pause so that we can like figure out a different way to go about this. And I think the O card is just, no, you should be giving each other also positive reinforcement when something is really good for the whole table. And I just think that's like such a community building safety tool.
I couldn't agree more.
You're like, that's why I made it.
No, I'm so happy to hear you say that because mm-hmm. I still think back with such grief of stories that were told of me, of kind of like awful experiences people had many, many years ago in role-playing tables that were unsafe. And then like stupid arguments I would get in with my college friends about like player intent and if only there were safety tools to kind of deal with that. And that just scratches the surface of like the kind of harm that could be done. And so I do love all safety tools. Mm-hmm. I think that they're very smart. And I have a little speech that I give, especially at cons, in which everybody are strangers and you need to establish that kind of trust. And so start with the X card, move into lines and veils. And lines and veils is great. But for me, it's this elephant in the room. You have this list of the most awful things you can imagine. And now, especially as strangers, you're trying to enter back into that emotionally vulnerable and sensitive place that like role-playing often requires. Not just if we're playing a sad things on card crying game, but even like your standard kind of dungeon-y crawl thing, like the empathy and the connection that you're being asked and the buy-in that you're being asked to do is wildly powerful and very, very, very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so one thing I do in the lines and veils, particularly if it's on online, so it's like an easy sort of thing you can add, I add a yes, please column. Mm. And so people put things down. And so they can also add to the bottom of the list, because of course, on a lines and veils list, people are adding their own things of the most horrific things they can imagine. But at the bottom, there's sort of like, you know, you can imagine a line is like an automatic X card. The yes, please is like an automatic O card. Mm-hmm. And again, it adds the levity, like we can have both. We can say like, absolutely, there's going to be no torture. Or if there's racism, it happens out of scene because we understand we're in a city. But I have no interest role playing through that scene. And it's again getting people and also people not having consent to the stuff that happens in the game, especially in a con setting in which your steeple fingered GM feels like, oh, this is my world. Mm-hmm. I have total ownership over it. They're all tools of negation. They exist because you're trying to carefully cut around things until you have this Swiss cheese of an experience. And so they're like a little minefield. And so absolutely, the idea of, especially in a horror game, mm-hmm. when people are like, actually, you look down at the gravel and you're on finger bones. Is this something that people are into? And if people are hitting their ochre at the table, it's this burst of glee and it gets people together. And especially for horror games, like, it's not about like removing what is horrific. It's about knowing what you can hit the gas on. Mm-hmm. And so you can explore and have that space in the best possible way.
Well, thank you for coming on to chat with me today. It's been wonderful to hear about your game philosophy a bit. Is there anything that you want to kind of promo for yourself or ask people to look out for before we sign off?
Yeah, the last game that I wrote was the premiere of the mega game Skyre through my capacity as playing culture lead at MythWorks, responsible for games like The Wild Sea and Slug Blaster Kickflip over a Quantum Centipede. It was a bunch of people all playing CBR plus BNK, which is a very, very pared down hack of Blades of the Dark, but it was all in one big arcology. The funny thing about mega games is you can't play test them. So that was the first time that it was on its feet. There are videos that were taken by Ray Chow, who is the creator of Skyre. And we are hoping that at PAX U, we will bring it back for Skyre 2.0. So look for that. Look for us. Come play some MythWorks games. It's going to be great.
Awesome. Well, thank you again. And for everyone listening, you can find, we'll put links to Graham's work in the description box below. And you can find us on social media at QueerPG, QueerPG Pod. Also at our Patreon, if you want to come over and help support us so that we can make this podcast happen. But for now, until next time, bye everybody.